This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will lead us through the latest considerations on the syndrome of delirium, with a focus on post-acute and long-term care. A 2008 Archives of Internal Medicine article that reflected on a Yale study geared toward delirium prevention more than 10 years earlier concluded that the United States financial burden of delirium on the healthcare system ranged from $38 to $152 billion each year, rivaling the costs of falls and diabetes. And this was 20 years ago. We now understand that delirium is associated with increased morbidity, functional decline, nursing time, caregiver burden, higher hospital costs and greater lengths of stay, increased rates of nursing home placement, and death. Regardless of the studies and interventions, delirium, for our colleagues in the trenches, remains a devastating geriatric syndrome, a dangerous blade, so to speak, that cuts swiftly, easily, and without mercy. Despite all that we have learned about delirium, the American Delirium Society reminds us that while 7 million hospitalized Americans suffer from delirium, more than 60% of patients with delirium are not even identified by the healthcare system. How can that be? With consult teams comprised of geriatricians or psychiatrists or neurologists and with order sets and ongoing in-servicing, why is delirium still the sphinx of healthcare? Are we making any strides in prevention and treatment? What are the impacts of different healthcare settings like the post-acute and long-term care environment? In the 2007 article entitled A Brief Review of the History of Delirium as a Mental Disorder, the authors noted that the word delirium was written by Celsus in the first century AD. Where are we now with regard to delirium in the third millennium since? Well, I can think of no one better to help us navigate through the mysteries of delirium than Brown University's own national and international leader, educator, and researcher in geriatrics, Dr. James Rudolph. And we are extremely fortunate to have Dr. Rudolph with us now. Dr. Rudolph is a geriatrician and palliative care physician who is devoting his career to improving the care of older patients. He is the director for the Center of Innovation in Long-Term Services and Supports at the Providence, Rhode Island, VA, and he serves the VA Office of Geriatrics and Extended Care as the Director of Measurement and Quality Improvement. He is a professor of medicine at the Warren Alpert School of Medicine at Brown University, and he is professor of health policy and practice at the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Rudolph, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thanks, Dr. Saltzman, and thank you to your organization for including me. This is really a great honor.
Dr. Rudolph, I typically like to start with somewhat of a historical perspective to set our framework for discussion. In 2004, you and Dr. Edward Marcantonio, himself a national, international leader in delirium research, wrote an article for The Hospitalist entitled Caring for the Postoperative Patient with Delirium, in which you noted the significant incidence of delirium among different surgical procedures, referred to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the then DSM-3R, and its criteria regarding the confusion assessment method, the CAM, for diagnosing delirium, and offered some recommendations among different modalities for preventing delirium after hip surgery. Now, we fast forward to 2017, and you and others publish in the Geriatrics Clinics, the quarterly periodical, an article entitled Dissecting Delirium, in which you propose phenotypic categorical models of delirium and discuss short, intermediate, and long-term negative health outcomes, with some outcomes no longer thought to be reversible. The science of delirium seems to have evolved, especially over the past 15 years. Talk to us about this evolution. I have so many questions to start. Has the definition of delirium changed now that we have the DSM-5? Is the CAM still the screening tool of choice? Are cognitive processes of consciousness and attention still important as foci? What do we know now about outcomes from delirium? Does clinical setting matter? Do we know more about predisposition or risk factors? And of course, with all this focus on the negatives of antipsychotics, what do we know now about the use of pharmacology in the prevention or treatment of delirium? So many places to start.
Yeah, so let's start at your beginning question. So DSM-3R, which is what the CAM was based on, was a revolution in delirium. And it really, one of the key things it did is it solidified inattention as the core cognitive deficit of delirium. And there have been revisions to DSM, including with DSM-4, text revision, and then 5 now. What DSM-5 did is it really put that inattention upfront as the primary criteria. In addition to that deficit in inattention, there was a de-emphasis on the consciousness portion of delirium. However, if you read the fine print, it's actually still in there, and that patients who can't wake up, they probably have delirium. The other really big change with DSM-5 was the addition of another cognitive deficit. At the end of the day, you know, these criteria, while they're evolving with our knowledge of delirium, what's really fascinating is that clinically, delirium that was diagnosed, you know, in 1990 using DSM-3R, delirium that was diagnosed in 2004 with DSM-4, delirium diagnosed today with DSM-5, they're probably all in pretty solid concordance, at least. The armament of the frontline clinician has really improved. And that's I think, one of the exciting things in delirium. When the CAM first came out, it was a diagnostic algorithm and then perhaps a longer screening checklist. Most people are more familiar with the diagnostic algorithm. What happened with the advent of the CAM ICU and subsequent versions is we've operationalized the definition. So no longer are we dependent on an interpretation of what is disorganized thinking, because we have concrete questions to ask about disorganized thinking. And no longer are we, you know, sitting and debating what an alteration in consciousness is, because we have better scales and tools to do that. So I think there are clinical tools that can be used by frontline clinicians to assess delirium, and that's really a major tool that we've developed over the past 15-20 years that really can come into play. I think the implementation part of that is really where we're struggling right now, and I'm hopeful that in 15-20 years we have that part solved. What we do know is that if you just go in, ask untrained people, check a box as to whether these criteria are satisfied, the sensitivity of that is really, really low, that we're not really going to pick up a lot of delirium. It takes actual cognitive assessment, engagement with the patient, to really be able to diagnose delirium. At the end of the day, it really comes down to, is this patient inattentive? And I want to digress a little bit into brain physiology, just because we're really learning more and more about this, and this is one of, I think, the exciting parts. Yeah. You know, the attention center is sort of the quarterback of the brain. It receives stimuli and it recruits other brain domains or brain cognitive functions to tell the body how to react to that. If that's impaired, it's really, really, it becomes a real problem, both not only from the long-term potential, but as we're sitting there talking to the patient. If a patient can't process cognitive stimuli, like talking to the patient about their diagnosis or telling them to help plan their discharge, then they're in real trouble. There's other cognitive processes like arousal. If they can't wake up enough, they're not going to be attentive, and their other cognitive processes are not going to function. As well, awareness. If they can't receive cognitive stimuli, that's going to be a real problem. So there's these brain functions, and I always go that arousal is the most primal function, then awareness, then attention. But these cognitive functions are critical. And so as we're going through our discussion today, linking back to how if these processes are impaired, it's really going to impact cognitive outcomes and potentially functional outcomes. And as I was doing some thinking about this today, in the post-acute long-term care setting, if you can't attend, there's a whole list of challenges that patient's going to face. Sure. The other thing that's come in delirium is that we're becoming a lot more sure about long-term outcomes in delirium. And it's not a pretty picture. That delirium, while always thought of as a short-term, you know, the brain function goes down, the brain function comes back, and they go about their time and live their life, well, that's not as true as it once was. You know, where studies are now panning out where delirium is clearly associated with poor functional recovery, and we're getting more and more evidence that delirium can be associated with long-term cognitive outcomes. And there's some anatomic studies that are showing that delirium may actually alter brain anatomy, so that the short-term outcome all of a sudden has long-term consequences. Mm-hmm. And that's really that's really a pretty exciting finding for delirium scientists. It's a really bad finding if you're a patient. One of the things we've always done, and this is a little artificial, is we assign delirium to where the patient comes from. You know, if they go to surgery and they have cardiac surgery, we assign, oh, they're a cardiac surgery patient. You know, they're about 50% of cardiac surgery patients will become delirious afterwards. And we kind of assign it to, okay, they had this big process and you know, they'll recover. We've assigned patients to medical wards. We have assigned patients to ICUs and various conditions within that. And I think it matters to some degree. I think what we have to think as clinicians about is how vulnerable was this patient to begin with to delirium? What was the size of the stress we exposed them to or their illness exposed them to? And then how can we get them back on their pathway to recovery? Sepsis is a much different illness than an elective orthopedic surgery. It really is, and that's some of the information we're starting to tease out, is that all delirium may not be equal. Now, we'll probably have this discussion, but there's a group of us who really believe that we aren't making progress in clinical recognition of delirium, so we should kind of keep all delirium together. But those scientists who really want to study individual pathways are saying, no, we need to split delirium apart because delirium from sepsis is really maybe much, much different than delirium in a end-stage dementia patient. Yeah. The other part is that we're learning more and more about some of these risk factors. Now, we've known for a while that patients who have dementia or pre-existing cognitive impairment are much more likely to have delirium. That's not surprising. The brain, the vulnerable brain, more risk to some of these stressors, and would go on to develop delirium. What's becoming interesting is a couple things, I think, at least. First is highly functioning people, executives, small business owners who have delirium through sepsis or whatever, often will tell really remarkable stories about how the delirium or their illness affected their ability to function beyond that. So not only is it the low performers, but all of a sudden the really high performers can very much describe how their delirium was a fundamental turning point in their life. The other group of there's two other groups of patients that this is becoming really important in. And I'm a geriatrician and palliative care physician, and who I've learned the most from over the past 5 years or so are the pediatricians. And we never thought about delirium in kids, but you can imagine if you're a young child in an unfamiliar environment, your brain connections aren't fully formed, and you have these terrible hallucinations, that sticks with kids. Delirium is a disorder of attention, not memory. And so a lot of patients with delirium will often remember their delirious episodes. That seems to happen a little bit more in kids. And it can be really, really traumatic to the kids. The other group that I would say is really important is those patients who are in hospice or palliative care. And if you think about distressing symptoms for both patients, for families, caregivers, and the team surrounding that patient, delirium rises up. And so there's a strong group looking at how do we characterize and manage delirium in palliative care patients. The final part is that we don't have a drug yet. and that's the bottom line. And I should rephrase that to say we don't have a drug, period. I think delirium is a syndrome, or I don't even think that. I know that delirium is a syndrome, and a syndrome is this constellation of symptoms. What we're learning, and what some of our work was talking about, is that there's these multiple pathways, and it's a little naive of me as a scientist and you as a clinician to think that this drug is going, you know, this drug that acts in the brain is going to affect those pathways that are causing the delirium, and all of a sudden revert the system to normal. I think the brain is a little more complex than that, and I'm humble enough to admit that we don't know nearly enough to be thinking that drugs are going to treat delirium. Drugs may manage some of the symptoms associated with delirium, but even then, we get surprised all the time. There was a study by Mira Auger in 2017 in palliative care of patients, randomized trial, Haldol, ziprasidone, and placebo. And believe it or not, the patients who got placebo had lower delirium symptoms than the other two groups. So it's even when we think we know that these are the right medications, we don't necessarily know. And so we continue to learn. And that's part of the fun of it. The challenge is that patients continue to suffer. And so we need to keep our foot a little bit on the accelerator too.
So continuing on with the focus you had mentioned, post-acute long-term care, in 2017, the Journal of Osteopathic Medicine had an article entitled Delirium Update for Post-Acute Care and Long-Term Care Settings, a Narrative Review. The author proclaimed that relatively little attention has been given to delirium in elderly patients in these settings, and delirium prevention strategies have not yet been shown to be beneficial. So questions from this, you know, do you agree with this assessment? Any post-acute care provider can relay stories of the remnants of delirium that they see from the acute care setting. But what about screening strategies in the skilled nursing setting? Do we have adequate tools? Are nurses, you talked about training, are nurses trained well enough to assess for delirium with timely documentation and communication around their findings? Should delirium assessment and management be part of a quality assurance and process improvement or QAPI strategy in the setting? And if so, where should we first start in addressing the issue?
Again, that's a very cool question. And the first is, I want to go back to the little pun that the author put in there, you know, that relatively little attention has been given to delirium in the post-acute setting. You know, right. I think that's awesome. So I would agree with that part of the assessment. And let's think about this from a system standpoint, right? That if a patient comes into the hospital with an acute illness or needing a surgery, The post-acute care setting is going to be the recipient of, I don't want to say the failures, but the patients who don't go on and don't have the support to be able to go home. The optimal discharge, we'll say, is home. Yeah, I mean, we can argue about the nuances of that, but the post-acute care setting, just like you mentioned, they're receiving a lot of the patients who didn't really pass the hospital. So they're much more likely to get those patients who are delirious than the patients who don't go on to develop delirium. And I think we've forgotten along the way that those patients who go on to get delirium, they really challenge our post-acute setting. First, because if they truly have inattention, all of our planning around how we're going to rehab them and get them up on their feet and independent in their IADLs and their functional levels, all of that is predicated on the brain functioning appropriately. They need to receive stimuli, recruit the right brain sections or brain functions, and respond appropriately. And if that quarterback is impaired of attention, we're going to really struggle to get that patient on their feet. Now, I think that a lot of times the post-acute care setting is the appropriate setting for those patients because we need to stop some of the madness that goes on in the hospital setting. You know, that the patient isn't getting better and the hospital teams are feeling pressure and it's a high pressure environment, just like the post-acute setting, and stepping them back into a setting that's a little bit slower and we can really systematically assess them and peel off some of what's happened to them in the hospital. I think that's often a beneficial strategy to patients. However, the author is right on the is largely right on the prevention strategy, so that we've been neglectful in looking at how we can not necessarily prevent delirium in the post-acute setting, but begin the strategy of treating the delirium that the patients come in with first, and then preventing delirium. Because I think that if our goal in the post-acute setting is to get patients back to their functional levels and return them to home, then we need to really recognize that we need that brain to function appropriately. And then and getting the quarterback up and running is critical to making sure the team functions appropriately. As you were talking about some of the stories that post-acute providers, I think we have some strengths in the post-acute care setting and the long-term care setting that aren't existent in the acute care setting. First is, and I'm going to say three letters that are going to send shivers up most of your audience's spine, but the MDS, the minimum data set, actually includes a screening for delirium, and it's done after a cognitive assessment. So there's the BIMS followed by the CAM. Now, whether your team gets access to that data or whether that's conveyed to the team, I'm not entirely sure. I think it's when we look at screening that's been done according to MDS, the prevalence of delirium on that initial screen is roughly about 5%. From studies that have been done, that's about half of the delirium, or maybe a third of the delirium that's probably present on admission in a post-acute setting. So it's imperfect, but it's way more perfect than what the hospitals have, because there's nothing in that setting. So, you know, if the MDS is triggering for delirium, then that should be a big flag to the professionals taking care of those patients and the teams taking care of those patients, because really the patient's going to struggle to rehab while that delirium is present, and so delirium probably should shift to the focus. The other thing I was thinking about is in going through this is, yeah, and I'm going to bring up another thing your audience isn't going to like, but when you look at the quality measures CMS uses to calculate the nursing home 5-star compare rating, a lot of those quality measures are either the are either a result of delirium or a consequence of the delirium, or sort of a prelude to the delirium. For example, acute antipsychotic prescriptions. I know your audience is a bunch of is a group of professionals, so they're not prescribing antipsychotics as sleeping medications. They're giving antipsychotics because the patients are agitated and in distress, and they really need something to modify their behavior. Guess what? An acute change in behavior, that's like a red flag for delirium. We've done some work that when acute antipsychotics are prescribed, 80% or 85% of the time, delirium is the underlying cause for it. So just there, that's a quality measure to think about. Remember that delirium is not just that patient who's up and throwing their shoe at you and biting you and thinking you're stealing things from their room. Delirium is also that sedated patient who won't wake up and won't participate in rehab, and 2 weeks go by and nobody really knows why this patient won't engage, and the family swears that they were living independently prior to that. So I think that there's real benefit in some of these quality metrics. As I mentioned before, there's a study by Cyrus Kozar in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society in 2017 that looked at MDS delirium after hospitalization and found longer length of stay, higher mortality, more likely to be readmitted to the hospital, and more likely to be admitted to long-term care. So less likely to go home afterwards. Oh, and less functional improvement as well. So you know, as we're looking for reasons to look at delirium in a post-acute setting, there's plenty of reasons to look at delirium in the post-acute setting. Sadly, I think we still have a knowledge gap amongst our profession as physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants, certainly amongst the nursing corps in long-term care facilities, and then even amongst the nursing assistants. So there was some work looking at the nurses' knowledge of delirium, and these were nurses and nursing assistants in long-term care settings. And as you might expect, agitated delirium is often identified as delirium. But when we began to look at hypoactive variants of delirium, our rates dropped. And when we began to look at delirium superimposed on dementia, the rates dropped further. And so, I mean, and the rates dropped to shocking levels in the 30% range. So delirium, there's a real knowledge gap in delirium in according to the literature in the post-acute care setting. And so that leaves an opportunity for training for sure. I think the more exciting part would be to think about this, to combine that training with some quality improvement processes. Mm-hmm. And again, if you're looking at your CMS quality metrics and your MDS data and finding out where perhaps at your facility, the individual, I'm going to put this in air quotes, poor performing points are, that can be the start. And you know, delirium can be the sort of the foundation of moving those. Even if, you know, if your metric is restraints, or your metric is we're doing too many readmissions, or your metric is there's not enough or there's too much functional decline in our group, then beginning to say, hey, is this a functional decline problem, or is this a delirium on admission problem that we can actually use multiple methods to try and improve the knowledge, the screening, and then the ultimately to work towards a solution for the improving the quality metric. So I think there's enormous opportunity in ways the post-acute care setting is, and the long-term care settings are way further advanced than the hospital setting in this. And often it's the right place to do a lot of the quality improvement work and the innovation in there. So I think that I'm really excited about the setting as a potential for improving delirium.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from Afoundria, the creators of ChartPath. Our world is changing, and the demands on your practice are growing. Nobody wants to just buy an EHR. You want a technology partner by your side. That's why they built ChartPath, a simple-to-manage and simple-to-use EHR backed by a dedicated team 24/7 that will guide your practice through MIPS and help you manage your growth. Most importantly, ChartPath is efficient, so you can continue to give your patients the high level of care you are known for and still make it home in time for dinner.
We are having a fascinating discussion with Dr. James Rudolph, and frankly, we're learning more about delirium now with him than I think we ever learned in medical school or in training. Dr. Rudolph, I want to take a deeper dive into a delirium resource that I've already mentioned, but one that I know is near and dear to your heart, but I fear that few know about. In your clinics article, you discussed how delirium was increasingly being recognized as a scientific discipline, now with the establishment of professional societies across the world. So tell us, please, about the birth, so to speak, of the American Delirium Society, for which you were the founding president and now serve on the board of directors. What is its mission, and how has it helped us to understand the science of delirium as well as the prevention of, treatment of, and consequences of delirium? You know, it's, as I reviewed the site again, its members are not just physicians or clinicians. It reaches a very broad base, even in its leadership. How can it serve as a resource to us practitioners in the trenches?
So thanks for the question. The American Delirium Society, like all great innovations, began in a bar room, you know, and it was three or four of us sitting around late at night after another conference talking about why delirium really needed its own niche. And the reason for it needing its own niche is that it's not confined to one specialty. As you mentioned earlier, psychiatrists, neurologists, geriatricians, hospitalists, nurses, everyone has a seat at this table. And now we're learning pediatricians and palliative care physicians and intensive care physicians. Lots of people have a seat at this table. And we're so young in the field that we really felt pulling a society together has strengths. And one of the things that we were commiserating around that night as we were forming the society was the fact that as delirium, you called me a guru, but as sort of the delirium experts at our institutions, we were alone. And a lot of physicians and nurse practitioners who practice in geriatrics, a lot of your audience who practices in nursing homes understands what it's like to sort of be the person, you know, that at my institution, I was the delirium guy. And whenever there was a case that made it to risk management, or there was a need for a lecture, there was the delirium guy. We could go get the delirium guy. And I think that a lot of our leadership felt that way. But together, we felt we had a better voice than we had as individuals. Now, our mission at the American Delirium Society is to foster research, education, quality improvement, advocacy, and implementation science to minimize the impact of delirium on short and long-term health and well-being of patients. Now, that's a hugely broad mission. What I will say is that what's happened in the American Delirium Society is we've begun to form a network. And one is a network where we support each other, and the other is a network where we collaborate. So we've seen an evolution. Originally, it was a bunch of researchers who got together to talk about what they were doing, and now we've seen that it's more than that. There's a group of researchers who still come, but they come because their collaborators are there. not only locally, but internationally now. The other group that's really stepped into the fold in the American Delirium Society are the quality improvement people. So at this last meeting, we had a session that was three major health systems in the United States, and one of the health systems was Kaiser, and they were talking about their delirium program that they had developed, and the program started as a hospitalist and a psychiatrist at one hospital. And they had good results, or they had what they felt were positive findings. And this is the beauty of a health system. And they presented it to their leadership, and they said, leadership said, hey, this is pretty good. Let's move it to a regional model. And they're on the regional model, and now they're shifting to a broader national model. That's the kind of collaboration that, the American Delirium Society feels very strongly that we at least gave the folks at Kaiser, those first people who were really innovative in this area, gave them a voice to say, no, what you're doing is right, and we've run into similar problems, and here's what to expect next, and they've taken it and run with it. And so we've given them a home where they feel supported and can bounce ideas off of us and things like that. As your audience is providers in post-acute settings and long-term care, to me, that's the wide open west right now. That I've already talked about the vulnerability of the patients in the post-acute and long-term care setting, but as we're thinking about how do we improve this and how do we improve it, perhaps not only in the homes that I'm medical director for, but those homes are part of a chain, and geez, we could really grow this within a chain. That becomes we could become a very nice home for someone like that to support them through their project. And what you get at the American Delirium Society is a lot of experts who come together and are really approachable at that time. So that it's not uncommon to see some of the giants in the field who are walking around the poster presentations, and you can go up to them and say, hi, I'm doing this. What do you think? And that's a really, really empowering for people who are just trying to kick off a program or just trying to get a foothold in how to do this. Just to have someone say, I ran into some of the same problems, and here's how we handle them. And that network, just like in the AMDA or the post-acute long-term care medicine association, that network is actually really, really critical. And again, nice organization, nice size, and really open to learning.
Dr. Rudolph, as has become customary in the time that we're remaining, I wish to be a little provocative with you. The International Federation of Delirium Societies, known as iDelirium, proclaimed March 13, 2019 to be World Delirium Awareness Day. How much more aware of delirium can we be? Is heightened awareness, beyond our training and screening methods, going to alter the incidence and prevalence? Is delirium something that we can think about eradicating? What are you envisioning as the future as you and others consider innovations in the treatment and prevention of delirium? What are the potentials that come to your mind?
Yeah. So I think, Wayne, one of the most depressing facts that keeps haunting me in delirium is that Joe Francis in 1990 published a study showing that clinicians miss 75% of delirium. And the studies that have come out since then, that number is pretty close to rock solid. Wow. So we're not doing a great job in identifying delirium. I have my theories on why that is, but we as healthcare professionals do a lot of attribution. How's that? that we assign delirium to particular causes and don't call it delirium. The other part is that delirium is largely unreimbursed as a diagnosis. I put that in air quotes as well. And so there's I think there's a lot of things could move awareness of delirium forward. One of the most powerful things that's come out of World Delirium Awareness Day is the patient and family stories of delirium, of how nobody recognized that someone had delirium until World Delirium Awareness Day often, and they said, "Oh my goodness, this is a thing," and then they do a little reading and they go, "This was me. I had this condition, and no one recognized it." So I think that there is not only awareness amongst our profession and nursing and nursing assistants and physical therapy and all those groups, but I think that there is a real network to be gained internationally. And that's really the heart and the soul of World Delirium Awareness Day, is to continue to connect us all. And we, you know, it's run as a social media campaign, so it's a little bit broader than the medical literature which you and our colleagues might read. So there's some real opportunities, and we can continue to see it. Now, is awareness going to change our screening protocols? Probably not. And because it's really hard to change a screening protocol. And I don't know that it's necessarily going to alter the incidence and prevalence. What I do hope it will do, though, is inspire the front line. Listen, I've been at this for 15 or 20 years now, and I don't have the answer. But I'm smart enough to know that the a lot of the answers that are going to improve the lives of patients come from our very frontline providers. And I'll give you an example of this. I was running a delirium program in Boston, and I went in to talk to our sitters, and I very much dislike the term sitter, but these were frontline people who were paid, and this was their job, was to hang out with agitated patients.
A one-to-one.
And as I was going in there, thinking I was all high and mighty and things like that, and I actually had a toolbox of stuff to hand them, and I thought, this is going to be great. One of them told me about how his first task when he arrives at 11 o'clock at night was he would always take the patient and give them a bath or a shower. And after that, he kind of soothed them, and he never really had a problem with that. And another told me how she sang to the patients, and that seemed to calm them. And it's just the opportunities for frontline people or frontline staff to improve the lives of patients in delirium is out of this world. How we systematize it, I don't exactly know, but is one solution going to fit all? Probably not. But there's a lot of opportunity for innovation in this. And I think that that's going to be the real benefit of awareness, is that we're going to get some ideas from the front line that have real teeth. And I'll go ahead and I'll give out one of my best ideas, right? I think most of the delirium prevention strategy we have that are literature proven could actually be consolidated into an app, right? So, you know, if you look at Sharon Inouye's 1999 New England Journal article, there was hearing enhancement, vision improvement, cognitive stimulation, avoidance of dehydration, and avoidance of toxic medications, and I think they had a mobility program. So you build an app that has a hearing amplifier. All of our iPhones or all of our smartphones could potentially be a hearing amplifier. You can use the camera to improve vision. You can put cognitively stimulating activities on it, and you can put in reminders for patients to get up, or for families, you can text them now to get their patient up and walk them. It's not rocket science, but I can't build it. But I know that someone in your audience probably could look at that and go, "Oh, my daughter is a programmer and could probably zip that off in a weekend." I think there's huge opportunities for what we can do for patients in this field. And so I'm really, is as depressing as our recognition statistics are, I'm very excited for the future of delirium. And the reason is, because we're now beginning, or each year we're beginning, each decade we're beginning to recognize more and more how toxic this fundamental decompensation in core brain functions is. You know, it's really a bad marker for negative outcomes over the long haul. And I really think that some simple adjustments to our workflow and our recognition can have broad and big impacts. So I'm really excited about the potential. I don't think one size is going to fit all or one thing is going to ever come. You know, we're not going to get the drug for all delirium. I'm not that naive, but I think that a lot of our quality improvement projects that we're already doing could really be modified to incorporate delirium.
We have been privileged to speak with and learn from a true pioneer in the field of geriatric medicine, Dr. James Rudolph. Dr. Rudolph, what can I say? Thank you so much for spending your time with AMDA on the Go.
Thanks for having me, Wayne. This has been great.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast title. Thank you.